of making something new. But when it's taken too far, you get locked into a status quo. And creative thinking is about breaking free from the status quo, even from one you made yourself. That's why it's vital to know the difference between good planning and too much planning. Over the years, I've learned a thing or two, entirely the hard way, about the pitfalls of locking yourself into a predetermined course. I started out in the not-for-profit world of dance, where much of my sustenance came from foundation grants. I became adept at writing grant applications that required me to specify exactly what I intended to do with the grant money, from the music I would commission or license to whom I'd hire to design the costumes. No detail was left to chance. As a result, I fell into the habit of over-planning. Since I like to keep my promises, I developed a stoic reluctance to change. My focus on preparation and ritual made it difficult for me to veer away from my plan. But working in real time, in the real world, eventually showed me the error of my ways. I began to see that over-planning can be as pernicious as not planning at all. There's an emotional lie to over-planning. It creates a security blanket that lets you assume you have things under control, that you are further along than you really are, that you're home free when you haven't even walked out the door yet. When I was first considering writing this book, I thought about calling it How Not to Plan. The title appealed to the contrarian in me. I wanted people to take note that planning isn't everything, that being too organized can be a negative. It hems you into a corner, handcuffs you, and as a result, shortchanges your opportunities to be lucky. To embrace luck, you have to enhance your tolerance for ambiguity. Plan only to a point. The great military strategists, from Sun Tzu to Clausewitz, have advised that you can only plan so far into the battle. You have to save lots of room for your adversary's contribution. Let's take a look at some of the problems that can derail your well-laid plans. Other people. When I prepare to work on a project, the field general in me comes out immediately. I marshal all my forces. I carefully assemble my team, from dancers to technical support. Anything less would be underplanning. But people sometimes let you down. For every person who inspires you and pushes you in the right direction, there is often another who is missing in action, either because he's unreliable or simply closes you off rather than opens you up. No matter how well-intentioned someone else may be, things go wrong. Dancers get injured. A loved one is taken ill. Someone hits a creative roadblock, just as you're breaking through your own. And you have to be able to roll with the changes and work with them instead of resisting. The peg may have started out round, but it's square now. Hammering harder isn't going to make it fit. Relying too much on others, even in an inevitably collaborative process, makes you lazy. Don't get me wrong, I love the people I work with. Unlike the solitary painter or writer, I do nothing but collaborations. It's not me up there on stage dancing anymore. The dancers are my collaborators, as are the composer, the musicians, and the costume, set, and lighting designers. There is no one in the world more delighted than I when my production wizard, Santo Loquasto, with whom I have worked for decades, strolls in with a set of designs that blows everyone away. But I can't ever let myself think, well, this section of the ballet is subpar. Thank God Santo's set design will save me here. To protect himself against depending too much on movie stars, the film director Miloš Forman has a style that keeps many actors on edge. He won't show them the script too far in advance. He won't rehearse them. He won't permit them to launch into their arias. He just starts the cameras rolling and tells them to say their lines. Actors hate that. They feel unprepared under someone else's control, which they are. It's the director's duty to let nothing interfere with the telling of the story, and in Foreman's view, that includes the actors. He is the one with responsibility for the big picture, a perspective he has to maintain at all times, no matter what the priorities might be for the performer on that day's set. On the other hand, they have to admit it works. Three actors have won Academy Awards in his films. Foreman's efforts make his actors lucky. Perfectionism at the start. Another trap is the belief that everything has to be perfect before you can take the next step. You won't move on to that second chapter until the first is written, rewritten, honed, tweaked, examined under a microscope, and buffed to a bright mahogany sheen. You won't dip a brush in the paint until you've assembled all the colors you can possibly imagine using in the course of the project. I know it's important to be prepared, but at the start of the process, this type of perfectionism is more like procrastination. You've got to get in there and do. I used to bask in the notion that all my obstacles to creative efficiency would vanish if only I had exactly the right resources. My own studio, my own dancers, my own theater, and enough money to pay the dancers all year long, and to hire the best collaborators. But I've learned that the opposite is true. Limits are a secret blessing, and bounty can be a curse. I've been on enough big-budget film sets to appreciate the malignant influence of abundance and bloat. A good manager in business knows that there's never a moment in the business cycle when a company's objectives and resources are in perfect harmony. There's never an ideal balance between how many orders you have and how much inventory you're stocking. Your expenses and your income are never exactly in sync. One is always outpacing the other. Your people always demand more money, more resources, more investment spending than you're willing to give. You always have more phone calls to return or paperwork to handle than time to get it all done. Good managers know this instinctively, so they never plan on an ideal harmony they can't achieve. It's better to be ready to go than wait until you are perfectly ready. For my first dance, the 7-minute-long tank dive performed in room 1604 at Hunter College in New York City in 1965, I had no money, no scenery, no music, no stage to speak of. How limited is that? In fact, for my first 5 years, I choreographed to silence. And yet, those